Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Welcome to Den Talks, a podcast that features successful people from all walks of life taking us on the journey of self-discovery. This is Tal, and I had the pleasure of sitting with Chandres Bhardwaj, one of our senior teachers at the Den. He's also a co-creator of our teacher training program and the author of the book, Break the Norms. By the way, you guys, the Dalai Lama did the foreword to this. That's pretty incredible. He's a spiritual guru and international speaker who comes from a family and long lineage of teachers, although he admits being a huge troublemaker when he was growing up in India. We cover how death played a role in his spiritual journey, though in his 20s, he took a complete left turn to work on Wall Street, and also what are the traps of spirituality. He has some incredible stories about fate that you're not going to believe, and he really has a refreshing take on spirituality that is surprisingly very practical. Make sure you stay tuned till the end, where he will lead us through a very relaxing meditation. Here with Chandres Bhardwaj. Did I say it correctly? Because I know that's the
big... You got it. You have been practicing for 2 years.
I know, so. But still, I know that we also call him CB for those who
that's fun.
Have a little bit of trouble grabbing the name. Chandres wrote the book, Break the Norms. He's one of our senior teachers at the Den. He is a spiritual teacher, speaks, travels. I mean, you do everything as far as the spiritual world is. You're everyone's guru, I feel like now.
Thank you.
And you can find him everywhere, literally Instagram, Facebook. He's there when you need him, that's for sure. But I do want to go back because you did write this book, Break the Norms,
right.
And you are someone who people literally look to every day for guidance and advice and just comfort.
Mm-hmm.
But let's rewind a little bit because I find your history so interesting. You come from a family of spiritual leaders, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk
yes.
a little bit about that? Because it is incredible.
Right. So I you know, come from family of teachers, but, you know, a lot of people also think that when I was born, instead of crying, I started chanting mantras in hospital, which didn't happen.
You mean you're actually human?
I'm actually human. My teachers are superhuman, not superhuman, but just
actually
not,
human.
Actually human. So, but, you know, what that environment gave me was just a lot of freedom to explore my journey. Interesting thing is, never ever my father or grandpa, they told me to even sit and meditate. They never told me you should meditate or you should pray.
That was never part of your daily upbringing at all.
No, it was just my own, you know, love for it. I saw so much of meditation around me. I just wanted, I mean, as much as I can remember, I started doing meditation even when I was in second or third grade. And I don't know what I was doing. I would just sit and I would chant the mantras. And I was doing it so much that my father had to just calm me down all the time. You don't need to do this much. Just do a 5-minute thing and get done with it.
Now, did you know those mantras from just overhearing it from them, or had they sat down and spoken to
you? In the beginning, I would hear from them because that's what I saw all around me, honestly.
It was your language.
It was, right, it was my language. Sanskrit was not a foreign language to me. It was just a normal language, right? So I think it just happened in such an organic way. And I became so obsessed with just finding the truth behind spirituality. And for a long time, I was experimenting on my own. I was too young. And my father also thought, you know, he's just having his phase. And he's someone who never forced his spirituality on anyone. And he, you know, that includes me also. But when he started seeing that I'm really going deeper into this practice and I'm sitting sometimes, you know, for 5 hours a night and I'm traveling with him to monasteries and temples and I'm sitting forever. And he had actually had to, wake me up that this is good. What's happening? So I think that my dedication and my love or simply obsession for this, it gave him probably certain motivation that, he's here to stay in this. So that's when he started guiding me. And there were many spiritual incidents that happened. I would, just say things that, for example, we went to this great big temple in south of India. And I woke up one morning, I said, let's leave. And he said, why do you want to leave? I said, there's going to be flood in this town, so I don't want to stay here. And I was in fifth grade. And he said he's just probably, you know, he doesn't like it here. So that's why he wants to go back. But I, you know, threw such a tantrum that I want to leave. So mom, dad, everybody had to pack and they left. And as we were leaving the town, there was flood like behind us. And by the time we reached back home, his friends, they were arranging a helicopter to have a search for us because all the people who were there, they were just, you know, like they were nowhere to be found.
Oh, my God.
So that, you know, there were many incidents like that. I would say something and it would have a certain meaning. And that gave him, it scared him also a little bit, but it also gave him a lot of motivation that, you know, I'm onto something here. And
now your grandpa and your dad, both in this world and strong leaders and teachers themselves.
Right.
Did they have like moments like that as children as well? When they all talk about kind of their journey coming to who they are, did they have similar instances?
Many. I don't remember lots of grandpa's incidents, obviously, but my father's incidents, I remember a lot. He talks about lots of, you know, stories when he was young and he would just, you know, say things or do things that would come out to be big truth. And that's how he started becoming popular. When he was 20 year old, he said certain things which would end up becoming very powerful. For example, India never had a woman prime minister. And he was probably 21, 22 year old. That's when he said Indira Gandhi from Gandhi family, she'll become prime minister. And it got published in a newspaper. You know, there were only one or two newspapers at that time. And my grandfather was not like a people's person. He was more like a monk. He wouldn't come out very often. And my father was the spokesperson mainly for the spiritual part. When he said it, it got published in newspaper. And, you know, a year later, she became the prime minister. So that's when he really hit a big high. You know, that's when politicians started reaching out to him that how did you predict? There was no way she would become prime minister. And she was one of the most like powerful prime minister that India has ever seen. So these, you know, this is like one of the big incidents in his life. But there were many smaller incidents which gave grandpa a certain insight that, you know, this guy is onto something. So let's just polish him, nurture him, you know, accordingly. So our family has this history for sure, you know, of just seeing things spiritually and doing things, you know, in that way.
That's amazing. It's like the family business, but instead of grooming someone, you have to see if they're capable of being groomed first. Mm-hmm. And then they, like you said, polish mm-hmm. you. So, that's so interesting. So then your grandfather saw that in your dad. And then did they work together? I mean, you were just saying kind of he was the voice for your grandfather sometimes.
My grandfather was a very, like, by the way, we call him grandfather, but he was grandpa's real brother. But you always call him grandpa.
So he's like, right.
Uncle, yeah.
Right, grandpa.
My dad's uncle.
What is that connection? Right.
My dad's uncle, right. But we always called him grandpa. He was a monk. He never got married. He, you know, he would live in temples for many months. When he come home, he had a very strict routine, sleeping by 8 o'clock, waking up at 3 a.m., you know, meditating for hours and hours. So he practiced his spirituality in a very monk way, like how you see the monks. They don't, you know, they don't have office. They don't, you know, come out all the time. So he would come out once a week to meet people. So people wanted him more, but he wasn't available as much. So my dad started meeting people more often, and he would take guidance from father, you know, from grandpa. So they worked together in a way, in a collaboration, but they were not in each other's journey. So my grandpa did give my father freedom that you got to take this, you know, teachings out, because that's just how it has to be. I'm not going to do that. You have to be the one who will take this out. And yeah, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Yeah. So how old were you during the flood incident?
Oh, I was in fourth or fifth grade.
So you were really young.
Super young. I'm telling you, I was just throwing tantrum that I want to leave. And they thought I don't like it here because it's, you know, it's temple. But I'm glad they listened. And I remember we were driving back and my father told driver that, you know, let's stop. We want to have tea. And he said, we cannot stop because I can see the water. If we stop, it's going to be trouble. And it was raining.
I mean, you couldn't script this movie any better. That's like high drama.
It's high drama.
Wow. And so that was the moment your dad. And did he actually say something formally to you, or did you just notice the difference?
There has never been any formal, you know, training, honestly. Like, it started by traveling with him. He would make me do things. If I go to Ganges River in India, he would give me his beads. He would say, just, you know, wash these beads. And while you're washing, do this mantra. And sometimes he'll say, you know, take this mantra and write it on the paper. Like if he would want to give it to a client, he would make me do it. So there was a time I was still in high school and I was writing spiritual guidelines for all of his clients. And he was in US, I was in India, but he would make me do it in India. He was probably outsourcing, you know, cutting down his labor. But,
what else is family good for?
Right. But it gave me a lot of practice because he would, you know, tell me that this is what the person is. That's what the thing is. He'll do this mantra, that mantra. So he'll give me a brief outlook and I'll create the whole notes for the clients. And I enjoyed doing that, creating spiritual guidelines for people. And it would go to New York. He'll review it and then it would go to the client.
And he was in New York a lot.
Yeah, he started coming to New York it's been 15 years now. I was in eighth grade. I don't know what year would be that, but I was in eighth grade. Since then, he's been super active in New York.
Did you feel like, was he gone for big periods of time? Did you ever, was that hard for you as a kid or?
As a kid, you know, I don't remember that time, but he was away for first 7 years of my life. I did not see him at all, probably, in the first 6 or 7 years. I'm sure it was tough, but I started realizing it when I came, when I think I became a little, you know, old enough to understand he's not here. And I started realizing my friends, their dads, they live in the city, they have normal jobs or business, right? But my father seems unconventional. He's not home. When he comes back, people line up to see him, and there's like politicians and those kind of people. So I'm like, he's definitely important, but he's not here also. And I realized our family, you know, our family was, you know, different in the way how people would reach out to us. It was always, you know, guidance, or people, my school teachers would tell me, when is your dad coming back? I want to see him. So I didn't exactly, you know what he was doing. I would think he's astrologer, he's healer, or he gives people mantras. So it took me a long time to understand what his actual job, you know, really is. But my childhood was very interesting, you know.
So speaking of your childhood, we're hearing these incredible stories. Did you ever get in trouble? Were you ever like mischievous? Like what kind of child were you besides this kind of devout child? But like what, right. Was there another side to it also?
There was a huge side. My dedication, love and discipline for spirituality was on all time high. It still is. But my, me as a school student was all trouble. I was, you know, like officially given notice of suspension multiple times because they thought I create troubles in school. And I did, you know, for example, there was a mountain near our town and it had an itching plant, which means the leaves can cause you itch all over the body. So I would send a friend to the mountain to get the leaves and I would sprinkle the leaves on, you know, the desk of teachers.
Oh my God.
And our sister, I went to Catholic school, right? So sister thought, it's a terrorist attack. She thought,
oh my
that's
God.
What's happening. And that's when I stopped doing it. I'm like, oh, maybe they'll shoot me one day. So I did that. I would, you know, I had done lots of stuff. And I always had problems with school teachers, always.
So what would happen when you'd come home? Like these teachers who would always be like, when's your dad coming back? When's your dad coming back? Were they nervous to kind of send you home with this discipline? Like nervous your parents would?
There were different groups. The ones who would give me suspension notice, they were the ones who didn't want to see my dad. You know, the ones who really loved me, they were the ones who wanted to see him. And it was for them, I wouldn't do crazy things also, that because I knew they believe in me. So those teachers were my, you know, supporting system, which were few. And I had like super serious troubles with the teachers. I mean, they had actually written, you know, letters to the principal that this guy cannot be promoted to the next class, but I would have such a high GPA, they couldn't even hold me back. So there was, and I was always...
So you were just causing trouble, and did you have a problem with their authority? Was it?
I think so. It was always like that. I mean, for so many years.
Did you feel smarter than them?
I believe so.
Probably. Sounds like a classic case.
I believe so. I mean, there was a point, I was in 12th grade, and I had such a, you know, intense... a situation with my school teacher. Again, he said he cannot be given the permission to take exams for 12th grade. And principal called me and I was, you know, she said, why you are doing this? And I said, she said, you are not coming to classes. And I said, I've not been coming to classes for 2 years, but I've been taking private tuitions from him. And now he's complaining because I stopped taking private tuitions. That's the problem. And this is why it's happening. And she got angry because that was a truth in those days, you know. Right. Students don't need to come to school, but they would pay the teachers extra for private tuitions. It was a whole business, you know. So she got angry and she said, why don't you sit here and run the school? Looks like you think you're smarter than me. I said, I'm not smarter, but that's why he's doing it. So there were intense situations. Like there was no middle ground. It was either suspend him or he's the best student. And the teachers who didn't like me, they would be surprised. Why would anyone, you know, call him a good student? Because he's just trouble.
Have you seen or spoken to any of those teachers now?
No, I think.
Do any of them know where you are now in life?
They all know. They all know. I mean, I do speak to the teachers who were very good with me. You know, we are still in touch. So I constantly thank her. She was my English teacher. So she remained our like class teacher for 2 years. So, you know, I'm so close to her. But the ones who I saw one teacher who really I had very intense situation with her. And I'm all compassion and love now. So I sent her a Facebook request. I saw her on my Facebook that, you know, maybe I'll add her. I'll give her like, thank you. She didn't add me.
She's like, I can't. It's too much.
So on one side, I was this dedicated spiritual kid who would meditate for hours, who would listen to everyone, who would guide everyone. But I, at the same time, I had huge problem with authority. It's less now because I think I don't care much now. But I would take it very personally at that time.
So how does one's parents who are very spiritual handle situations like that?
So my parents hardly would get to know it. I mean, I had never let the news reach out to them. Even when I got the suspension letter, they said, your father has to come to school. Otherwise, you cannot come. I said, he won't come. And they said, he has to come. I said, he won't come because...
Oh, you were really... I love it. You went to the bitter end with this.
And, you know, because I saw my father, he's such a loved man. He's such a nice, compassionate, kind guy, and they are going to bully him when they call him to school. They're going to tell him all the crazy stories. And I wanted him to come to school for something good I do, you know, not to listen to my, you know, craziness. And I love
that you've turned the story into you were protecting your father. That's how good of a kid I was.
Right. So I literally, you know, in my head, I was like, my father will not come here for this. I mean, if they honor me someday, then I'll call him. And I used to watch movies, you know, which would encourage this rebellious behavior. You know, one of my favorite spiritual teachers, Osho, he was such a rebellious teacher also. Yeah. And my grandpa was very rebellious. My father also is, but my grandpa was very badass rebellious teacher. So I think these people in my head, they inspired me that, you know what, you don't need to bow down. Now I don't care, honestly, unless it's super injustice that's happening.
Right.
But yeah, in those days, even if someone raises the voice at airport, I'll stop. I'm like, why did, you know, do you talk this way? And my cousins, all the younger cousins, they were like, nice. He's, you know, he's so rebellious. And now I keep telling them, please
be
compassionate. Please behave. And they're like, we learn from you.
When do you think that switch happened for you?
I think switch started happening probably around high school after 12th grade. Also, I lost my sister in 12th grade. You know, she passed away. And I started realizing the importance of life and death. You know, I started seeing life in such a different way. I did, you know, overnight, lots of changes happened. You know, my spirituality started having a different meaning. Like, I was always this meditative kid, but I was doing it for fun. You know, like, I would travel with my dad, you know, create notes for his clients. So it was fun watching their journey. But after her death, I started questioning the whole science of God, death, relationships, and what the heck, you know, it is. And I've been this kid who was in his own world, you know, and you could see I didn't care of losing a relationship because I was like, I'm never going to lose important people. And that's why I would be so strict with these people that, you know, I don't care. But losing her was such a, you know, game changer in my journey. I realized life is fragile and you can lose anyone anytime. And you need to honor the relationships in your life. So I started becoming very humble. And even if I've started meditating on Gandhi more, so, you know, Gandhi has this mantra that if someone slaps on your left cheek, you know, turn the right cheek so that he can slap you once again. I literally didn't do it, but I would meditate on his compassion, you know, Buddha's compassion. So before I was into goddess Kali, that's still my, you know, goddess to meditate on. But Buddha also became a major part in my journey. And I think that experience helped me open up in a big way to my family, to my friends. And I realized, you know, if you love someone, you got to let them know that you love them before it's too late. So that one incident, it started adding to my journey, my meditation, my purpose, the meaning, everything literally shifted. So that death really changed things for me.
She was sick, correct?
She was sick for a long time. Yeah, I was 16 years old. She was 19. And then 3 years later, I lost my best friend, who was, you know, my people thought we were brothers because we grew up from first grade since forever. Like, we finished high school together. Then I came to US. He remained in India. So these two deaths, I think they just shifted everything I thought I knew. Like, you asked me that, did you used to think you're smarter than them? Yes. And I realized I'm not smart. I don't know anything because I just lost two very important people in my life. And how do I make sense of this life and death now? So those few years, they were very haunting. You know, I lost my sister when I was in India, and I lost my friend when I was in New York. I was working in New York. I was going to college. I did very bad in my political science class. It was very one of the classes I loved, but I did very bad. And professor, you know, he got surprised. He said, you did good. What happened in the last exam? Because, you know, it was around the news sure. came to me. And he said, I want to give you one more chance. So when the next semester starts, take this exam again. And I said, I don't want to. Give me C+, C-, whatever it is. And he was surprised. He said, why do you want C+? Or, you know, you can get A- easily now. I was not interested anymore. I would leave home for a job. I wouldn't go to my office. I would just sit in Central Park. And I just lost the whole meaning in doing anything. I was like, if this is what life is, why the heck I'm, you know, in this rat race?
But interesting, but you still had your spirituality. You mm-hmm. were just questioning it differently. It didn't
yes,
make
in a
or
big
did
way.
It make you question. Pull away from spirituality in general?
It
doesn't
did not,
feel like it right. That's
not
interesting
at all,
though.
Yeah.
It just made you look at it at a different angle.
In a different way. I did question, you know, God in a big way. But it never doubted the existence of divinity, but I knew there's something more to it because it was almost like your illusions were broken.
And talk about the religion you were raised with and what
right.
God meant for you a little bit.
You know, I was raised in Hindu family, right? And but my father, you know, he's a very open-minded, you know, person. So there were Hindu schools in our town, but he never sent me there because those were not good schools. He sent me to Catholic school. So my days would start meditating in church. And in addition, I would go to Dalai Lama's monastery, which is Buddhist. In addition, I would go to Golden Temple, the most popular temple in India. It's a Sikh temple, Sikh yeah. religion. And my father, you know, he would tell me stories of when he lost everything in his life. He went to this mosque. It's a big mosque close to New Delhi. And he said, that's where I got back everything because it's such a powerful, you know, place. And I started going there with him. So as a kid, I was going to a Muslim mosque. Buddhist monastery, Sikh temple, Hindu temple, and Catholic school. And my friends would ask me, you guys are Hindu. Why do you go to mosque? Why are you going to Sikh temple? But that's just our, you know, our family is. So there was never any Hindu dominance. And still there is no Hindu.
So how do you feel like if you could kind of describe in your head what religion was to you then,
mm-hmm.
not now, but back then, with all of this influence, what was it?
Mm-hmm. Back then, religion was mainly, I think, just a doctrine to, you know, to follow, honestly. I remember I would go to temple with my nani, my grandma, every other day. And what I learned through religion was just how to stay in discipline, how to do your prayers, do, you know, be a good person, do good things, be fearful of God, all those, you know, pretty standard things. But the religion also teaches this is right and that's wrong. And sometimes it can corrupt you, you know, because you feel this is right because my religion says so. But moving from religion to Tantra was such an eye-opening, and I realized religion is good. It's a good constitution, but you also got to, you know, understand your spirituality beyond religion, and then still you can use religion for your own good. I mean, I still tap on to all the teachings of, you know, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, Sikhism, because these were the religions I really grew up with. Five religions.
It's amazing. I mean, that's what's so incredible.
It helps me connect with everyone today, honestly, because I understand, you know, where they're coming from.
And so then when you were going through these deaths, do you feel like it was more the religious part of you shutting down, or was it just simply like, I need to figure, or were you actually finding your own spirituality for the first time?
That's a good question. I think religious part definitely got shut down in this phase, because I realized just by going to temple, going to mosque and doing your prayers is not the main thing. There's more to it. And my meditations were nice and gentle, but probably I was just on the surface. I never got to experience the truth. So the first death was very shattering. I remember I was surprised. I was confused. I was in denial. But I remember when I heard the news for the second death, my friends, the first thing I did was going to my meditation, you know, altar in my place. And I lit the candle and I sat in meditation. That's the first thing I did. And I sat for like 1 hour. I cried, but I also meditated that night. So there was this big leap that I had taken, you know, in 3 years from just being in denial and angry. I realized that he's not gone. He's just gone the way I used to see him and feel him. Now he's here, there, and everywhere. So my perspective of looking at them shifted. Yeah.
That's incredible. Yeah. So then the thing I know about you, and I'm sure a lot of people who know you know about you, you had a weird left turn in here. Like listening to these incredible stories where you've had these amazing things happen to you as a child. You were raised with already these incredible spiritual teachers around you. You left it all and chose to go into like basically Wall Street and finance in New York. So
why?
What was behind that decision? Because normally it would be the opposite. Like you're ignoring your, you know, but it's like you embraced your calling weirdly. Like you really embraced it and then still chose to make a left turn. So what was that about?
It was, you know, it wasn't a conscious decision. It was just a blind rat race. So in India, you have to choose your major in high school. So I picked business and finance in high school. And then I came to US. And it was just, you know, you have to study, right? So I just blindly picked business and finance. And I'd never enjoyed that process in school. I started enjoying college life when I started writing spiritual articles in a business newspaper, you know, and it was first time they were having something, you know, like that, a spiritual column in a business newspaper. So it was getting, you know, very interesting exposure. And I did not leave spirituality. It was still such a part of me in college. And the reason I decided to work in Wall Street, because I thought I'll make enough money to fund Break the Norms. Break the Norms was always, you know, in my heart. And I thought, I'll stay here. I'll make good money through stocks. And I'll invest the money after 10 or 15 years and create this, you know, great spiritual school for people. And it didn't, you know, it took me just 3 years to realize that if I stay in Wall Street for 15 years, I'll use all the money to hire a board of therapists and spiritual gurus to fix me, because I think I'll be unfixable probably by that time. So I had to just, you know, end the journey. I ended it in 4 years, I think. Yeah.
Do you feel like, I mean, I know you probably believe everything happens for a reason, but what do you feel like you got out of that turn, that left turn, that kind of being part of the rat race for a little bit?
Right. I think, first of all, I learned it was a rat race. And I think never, ever in my life, I'm going to, you know, follow a rat race again. Secondly, I realized happiness lives within. I think I had to go through that messiness, because maybe if I wouldn't go there, I would still be thinking, you know, my friends work in American Express, my other friend is in hedge funds, and I'm just talking about spirituality, you know. So probably that experience was needed.
So you had confidence in,
exactly,
in knowing you were doing the right thing for you.
Exactly. And even in college, all of my acknowledgement, appreciation, my name, my popularity was because of my spiritual work, because I started writing. So every other professor, school students, I would have appointments, by the way, every day, free appointments. I never thought of obviously making it as a profession. So I would have, you know, set times that I need to meet Professor Erin at so-and-so because she wants to talk about stress. And I have some economics question from her. It was a trade-off. They will explain me the economics and the business. And then I'll be teaching them meditation and why they're stressed out and stuff. But I never realized why this is so effortless and why working in business and finance is an effort, but why talking about spirituality is effortless to me, it didn't occur for a long time.
And also how interesting that these teachers were seeking you out. Like, right. It's interesting that they were finding you, which is a kind of abnormal relationship.
It was.
And you like you said, you didn't even question it because it was so comfortable for you.
It was like a second nature to me.
But you know? You clearly have always given off a vibe or something that invites people in,
right,
to have that discourse with you, which is very rare and unique.
And now I look back, I realize the first 6 months in school, in college in New York were frustrating. I was like, where the heck am I? I did not enjoy that experience. But after 6 months, I got this opportunity to write. And that's when everything shifted. I would be happy. I would enjoy every day in college, mainly because I was, someone now. I was helping people. I had a purpose in school. I would go every day because I knew today, Professor Catherine has this question on meditation. She emailed me. So it became such a fun experience. And it took me a while to realize I need to quit this and stick to what comes so effortlessly to me.
So speaking of that, you left and that was to really create your brainchild, break the norms.
Right.
When did that start entering your mind and your ether? I mean, yeah. Clearly you were always meant to live in this world of spirituality.
Right.
But when did this specific book and this specific point of view start brewing for you?
So the idea was there, but I was never confident to implement this idea. And when I quit Wall Street, I started assisting my father and I told him that there are many things you guys are not doing in a modern way. So I'll introduce technology and all that stuff, so that, the work reaches out to more people. And he liked the idea. So I started, assisting him, traveling with him. And that was a great hands-on experience. And Break the Norms would be in my head, but I was never confident to share that with him. And I remember he did this talk in Sweden. And that was one day I was a little frustrated that it was a while, not too long, but it was a year or two, I think, that I was, in his organization. And he said, are you tired? Because you look a little unhappy. I said, I'm not tired, but I feel for how long I can do this. He said, you're 22. What do you mean for how long you'll be doing this? I said, this whole thing, I want to take spirituality into my own way. He said, what's stopping you? I said, and then I had nothing to say because the answer was, I don't know.
You were stopping you.
Right? What to do, how to do it. And I remember my father's close friend, he was also there. He was managing the entire event series. And he was there. Dad was there. It was 10 o'clock in Sweden. And they both just heard my idea out about Break the Norms. And they said, do it. You don't need to wait. And I said, is it perfect to launch? They said, there's no word called perfect and you got to do it. And if you do it, we promise you will have our unconditional love and support and we won't let you fall down. That's for sure. But you got to do this on your own and we are watching you from far. And that discussion gave me so much courage. I remember I did not sleep that night. I went to my room and I opened my laptop. I started creating notes for Break the Norms. And okay, this is it. I'm going to launch it. It's going to be great. But I did launch it right after you came back from Sweden. I opened the company. I opened Facebook page. That gave me a lot of courage, by the way. Facebook page got popular and that gave me a lot of confidence. And then I made the company called Break the Norms. Book was still not in the picture. It was just a platform that I wanted to create. Book started happening when people started asking me that, we love how you talk about, relationships, ego, sexual desires, attachments. Where can we read more about it? And there was no place I could guide them to.
Because it was yours, yeah.
So I decided to, and I was always writing. So I decided to, write it all in a book. And that's how book happened. Book took, I think, the longest time because I knew I don't want to just mess it up. I want to do it nicely.
A little perfectionist.
Right. So I was trying to do it in most perfectionist way, but I'm glad it came out nicely.
So if you could explain to everyone, for those who don't know Break the Norms, a little bit what it stands for. I mean, it's pretty clear in the title, but right. Still, if you could dive in a little bit.
It stands for, questioning everything you think you know about life, love, relationships, divinity, because we have such a label for everything. And the moment we label something, That said, we limit it. Like when I'm called spiritual teacher, I know I'm limited right away. If I'm called a friend, I'm again, you know, in limits. So I've never liked the life of labels. I've always wanted to love people without labels and relate to them without labels. So Break the Norms was my attempt to break those labels, break the conditioning, and help people see the true reality, which is beyond the labels.
See, yeah, it makes sense since you've been questioning authority from day one.
Right. So it was
there. It's just that theme of... It doesn't have to be a certain way.
Right. I believe I took my anger in a more spiritual or compassionate way, honestly. People ask me, what was your motivation for Break the Norms? It was anger, because I was angry with authorities that they are exploiting the people and the religious leaders who are supposed to lead you. They're not leading you. They're exploiting you. So
yeah, a lot of times it's easier when people just follow blindly than when people question.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, even to the smallest things, sometimes when I'm in lines and you see everyone's in two long lines and you look right and you realize it's an empty line, but no one's going there because nobody else went there.
Right.
And you're like, oh God, you would have saved 15 minutes if you just would have, you know what I mean? It's just everyone automatically follows.
Exactly.
They don't stop for a moment and question, which is, so it is amazing what you've brought to everyone.
Thank you. In
doing that, do you feel... what do you feel the trap in spirituality is for anyone who's kind of starting this journey? Do you feel like there is a little bit of that trap of just kind of following dogma or, you know, picking one teacher maybe and just, and I don't actually want to feed you any answer. So what do you...
There's a huge trap. I mean, spiritual world, spiritual industry right now is filled with traps. I mean, people are... given a certain script, this is what spirituality is, and that's how you will be spiritual. So that's my biggest challenge or trouble is right now with spirituality, because people who come to me, they come with a certain idea of what spirituality is based on the books they have read or the teachers they have been to. So they have ideas about what color your throat chakra should be, what color heart chakra should be. When I tell them, chakras don't need to have any color. You assign them colors. And they're like, no, we want colors because it gives them certain meaning, right? So a path, you know, I believe spiritual path is such a simple path. And it's so simple that people feel it cannot be this powerful. Just breathing can make me enlightened. Just breathing can, you know, help me achieve higher consciousness. But there are teachers, there are people who are selling a very insane, mad idea of being spiritual by doing this and that, by flexing your body in this way and by chanting this kind of mantra and that kind of, you know, mantra in the morning. So it gives people a certain complication in the head, and they feel this would be the path to truth, because it looks complicated. Truth is complicated, probably. So the trap right now is the scripts of spiritual teachers that they're throwing on others, that this is how you become spiritual. And people who have no knowledge, who have no training, they're just following it out of innocence because they want a teacher, you know?
It's so interesting. Yeah, because it's that trap between being learned and being spiritual and how much of, I know you and I, actually the first time you and I sat down and ever met, I think we spoke for 2 hours kind of about this concept about authenticity and just spirituality and knowing yourself versus feeling like you have to use a certain lingo or fall into a certain way or do it a certain way. And I think you and I very much bonded over that.
I know.
So it's interesting that we're talking about it now. But I remember one time you said something to me when I was asking you actually a question about, I think I said something where I was feeling nervous, feeling like, there's no way all these people know exactly that concept that person is talking about. And I said, I'm feeling this weird feeling inside that people just know how to answer the answers. They know what the lingo is, what they should say, what they're supposed to say about their breathing or what they're supposed to say. They've heard it so many times that I started feeling this falseness of, I think people are convincing themselves they're finding these answers.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember this conversation we had?
Of course.
And I remember saying to you, and it's very confusing for me because when I really think about it, I feel like I'm really far from whatever that answer is.
Right.
And you and I spoke a little bit, and I would love to talk about it now, a little bit about kind of the idea of what you're saying, kind of what books can sometimes almost harm you, even though obviously it's amazing that there's such outreach now in spirituality. And you could write Break the Norms, and that's affecting so many people in a positive way.
Right.
But back to the trap of books versus just growth and teacher versus just inward looking.
Mm-hmm.
Can you expand on that a little bit?
See, I feel this is such an important topic, right? I feel spirituality is a borrowed experience. You know, it's a borrowed knowledge. You can borrow it from a book or a teacher, but then you got to cultivate your own version of what spirituality is for you. And the problem is when people read too many books, they just become that bookish spiritual person, which hinders their spiritual growth. And I used to make this joke in the beginning of Break the Norms. I would ask them, have you been meditating? Have you been reading books? And they'll say, yes, you know, we have been reading books. So I would tell them, so for you, the fee is $300. And for those who have not read any books, the fee is only $100. And they would say, why? Why is that? I said, you know, because with you guys, I'll need to work so hard to just, you know, get rid of all those ideas about what spirituality is. And it's still a struggle, honestly. Anyone who has read a lot, who has been reading different teachers, listening to different YouTube videos, constantly letting them know that Om is not this mantra. Being vegan doesn't necessarily mean you are spiritual, but they'll be like, oh, but she says in that book, being vegan means you are spiritual. And I said, I know a lot of vegans who are not at all close to spirituality. And I know lots of beef eaters who are very spiritual people. So that doesn't qualify for anything. But that's the illusion, you know, that we need to break.
It's so, and I think that's what you and I bonded over when I was, you know, came with the vision of the den. That was my big thing too, is spirituality should be for everyone. And I used to say almost exactly what you just said, like, if you drink alcohol, you're welcome. If you're sober, you're welcome. If you're vegan, you're welcome. Mm-hmm. If you're a meat eater, you're welcome. Right. It's none of those make you more spiritual. It's knowing who you are yourself and going on that journey is what makes you the most spiritual. So I remember so distinctly having that conversation. I find it such an interesting conversation in this world as it expands and is becoming more and more popular.
Right.
And I think, again, that's the give and take of it. It's a good thing, I feel like, that you can walk into, you know, a bookstore and there's a whole section now for spirituality. So it is making it more accessible and it's allowing people to learn. But at the same time, like you're saying, it really is trapping people a little bit and not figuring out how to grow for themselves.
Absolutely. These books are becoming a bridge to reach the higher consciousness, but so many books are also stopping people to reach higher consciousness. So I think it's such people got to feel spiritually independent. That's the thing.
How would you recommend doing that?
Spiritual independence is dealing with your own mess, basically, you know, self-acceptance. That's, I think, the first thing. You got to accept your ego, anger, greed, desires, attachments as a normal element of you. When you are made to feel that anger is not good, ego is not good, greed is not good, you start to hate a very strong part of you, you know, when you are made to feel your desires are not right. And you start having this guilt. Everything you eat and do, it's with guilt, because there are books around you telling that this is not the mindful way. This is the unconscious way. But no one is giving solutions. And when you follow that teacher and when you see that teacher is also doing that same action that he's calling unconscious, then you also lose the respect for that teacher, right? So then you never go that path again because you're like, you know, this whole path is corrupted. So I recommend starting with self-acceptance. You know, if it works, write down on a piece of paper that what it is, what makes me, who am I really? And that meditation on who am I, which we will do in the end, that meditation is, I think, pretty powerful. Just asking yourself, who am I? Watching your labels, watching how the labels have been limiting you, the relationships in your life, they have been limiting you instead of expanding you.
And so what advice would you give someone who, let's say, did something like actually did, you know, things they're really not proud of in their lifetime, whether it be to some, you know, it doesn't matter, something that society for sure would label not great behavior. And that's what they struggle with. How would you, in the simplest way, start getting them to self-accept?
So I've been going to rehabs for more than 3 years now. And I constantly, you know, see this every week there, that there are people who are told you are not a good part of society, you know, you're addicts, and that's not a good thing. So they taught me a lot, the people at the rehabs, you know, they became my healer in many ways. They helped me accept, you know, my own existence. So I feel when you start this journey of self-acceptance, the first thing, what, you know, our emotions are such a part of our energy, right? So I would feel, let's start with emotions, you know, watch your biggest dominant emotion. Is it anger? And if it's anger, anger is not the problem. It's the symptom of what's wrong within. So meditate on the anger, that what's causing this anger right now. If it's desires or addiction, again, addictions are not the problem. They're symptoms of something for a deep longing within, but you're just, you know, satisfying it with some addiction. So meditate on that addiction. And why am I having addiction with so-and-so? And I feel meditating or watching or just cultivating more muscles into that whole question, why this? That helps to open up a lot of acceptance.
In a weird way, it's labeling the label. So,
right,
yeah. So it's like getting rid of the labels, but at mm-hmm. least learning to make it just the label.
Right.
And so that you can rip it off. You can rip the tag
exactly.
off your shirt.
If you know it's a label, then it doesn't bother you. But we become our labels. That's a problem, right? If I'm aware of my labels, then it won't bother me. But when I become my label, when I become my story, then it's a problem. But understanding I have a story, I have a label, I have a certain emotion, but I'm not that emotion, I'm not that story. That's a very liberating experience, I think.
Do you feel in the world, like you have so many people who come to you daily that you work with, have you noticed trends? Like, is there, or is it really individual? Or do you notice like, oh God, yeah, in the last 2 years, there's been a lot of X, or in the last 6 months, a lot of Y. Do you feel that at all, or no? Is it totally?
It is more individual, honestly. I mean, there's definitely the biggest trends are anxiety and relationship problems. That has never changed.
And that's universal, right? Forever.
Right? But anyone who comes, but one thing I've been seeing, definitely people are willing to question more. They're hungry for more. Same thing when I experienced in Greece retreat. I walked in that retreat hoping or thinking that's going to be a mild retreat and nothing too intense. But after 2 days, people started opening up and we started doing this 10 p.m. meditation, and it would go on for until 12 a.m. or even past that, but nobody would get up. And I clearly saw everybody's hungry for deeper stuff. The Sunday classes at the Den, that's how they started. And I thought maybe I'll have just a handful of people, but they are the classes that are attracting the most interesting, you know, authentic seekers also. And repetition in the Sunday mornings, it's people are coming back again and again because they're sticking to that one, you know, cultivation. So I feel hunger is increasing for truth, for spiritual path.
It feels like that's the beginning. At least,
right.
At least start seeking, and then
that's for sure.
Yeah, that's amazing. So you are married, and your wife has known you since you were that kid in school, correct?
Yeah, the
troublemaker.
Yeah,
and she still likes you.
Right. I must be doing something right.
So she's known you for a long time, and you've been married now for how long?
7 years. I'll be completing 8.
Have you guys, do you notice a difference as far as how you relate in relationships? Like, or has she watched this whole growth of you? Like,
absolutely. You know, so one thing, that itching powder, all my friends were instructed, nobody will throw itching powder on her desk. So she was always like protected in that way. Like I liked her, but I wasn't like obsessively in love.
Right.
But I was in 7th grade.
Yeah.
I'm glad I wasn't obsessively in love. So she saw all sides of me. She has been seeing all seasons of who I am. And her acceptance of me was such a liberating experience for me. And I'm someone, you know, who's, I mean, if you read my book, you will know I'm not a big fan of institution of marriage. And I thought I will never get married. I was so clear about it. And I remember when this talk started happening, I mean, she was doing her MBA in Rishikesh. That's the yoga capital of India. That's where I do my retreats. So I would go there and everybody would think I'm going there because it's a spiritual town. But I used to go there to hang out with her because she was doing her MBA there. So my father got to know. And he said, you know, you're going there constantly, and I know why you're going. You've got to give certain respect to this relationship. You cannot be just going there, hanging out and coming back. So when the marriage talk, because it's such a big part of Indian culture,
yes.
You know, you cannot be just dating, you know, you've got to put a label on that.
So back I was like, to the labels.
Right. So I was like, this is against my norm completely. This is against my whole principle. And I stood on that ground, you know, that I'm not going to be married, but we can continue to be in love. I was, you know, putting a romantic side to it. And when things got a little heated, you know, she saw it and she's like, you know what? I'll tell them. I don't want to get married because, you know, it's going to create you'll be the villain. I don't want that. And I saw such a courage in her that, you know, in that conversation, because I realized I'm the one who's just being this rigid kid that I'm not going to be married because, you know, it's my so-called principle. But she's making this sacrifice. And, you know, being in India, this girl, it's a big deal for her to say that. So I thought, yes, number one, I never want to be get married. And number two, if I ever have to be married, it can only be for her. It can only be that I can break this norm. So that's how it happened. And I remember in Indian traditions, you know, we have to take 7 circles around fire. And each circle is a promise for something, you know, care of each other. It's like taking vows. So I remember after 7 circles, I told her to, you know, do the 8th circle with me. And she said, what's the 8th circle for? But I said, do it and then I'll tell you. And, you know, because I hope you trust me. Let's you know, do it. So we did the 8th circle. And I said, this is for not letting our marriage interfere in our love and friendship, because we were best friends. And then, you know, we became lovers. And now this institution is, you know, religion and society, they are poking their nose. I'm not liking it, but we'll do it if that's the way. But we will never let marriage interfere in our love and friendship. And obviously, she didn't really understand the meaning of it. And her cousins, they were looking at me. What are these guys up to, you know? But in past so many years, I have learned to relate to her in new ways, you know, and that's how I relate to everyone. I can never relate to someone in a fixed label. Like I look at my father some days as a teacher, some days as a father, some days as a friend, some days as just a human, you know. So that's how I relate to her every day in every way, because that freedom to me and to her, it's so important in our spiritual growth, emotional growth. And the reason I did not like marriage, or I don't like the concept of it, because I saw lots of possession of husbands dominating women. And I saw that in Indian culture. In North India, I've seen so many women who were being abused by their partners in the name of marriage. So that was my, you know, hate against the institution, my resistance against it. So I decided I'm going to give her complete freedom. She can be who she wants to be. She doesn't have to do things to please me. And it's easier said than done. You know, when
that's the rub of a relationship. It's hard.
It's tough. And when it started, and I completely realized it would hit my ego, the male ego, the husband ego. But I would remind myself, you were the one, Chandresh, who came up with this idea. So you got to do it. And then she got into meditation. So we were both into this, you know, same vibration. And then we started doing that for each other, to relate to each other as friends, as lovers, as partners, as guides, as just humans. And I'm glad, you know, we have come so far, and we still continue to relate to each other in that way.
Well, it's so interesting that you ended up breaking your norm, which was to break the norm. Right. So, I mean, you actually followed your own philosophy in some ways, just keep questioning. So even though you thought the answer for you was no marriage,
right,
you kept questioning it. And then she came in, and that's, you broke it for that reason.
Right.
And she's wonderful. So I'm so glad you did.
Right. Thank you.
No, she is. But and it's interesting that she gets to grow so much, because from where she came from too, like you guys have really shifted how you do marriage and partnership.
That's, you know, the biggest gift that I've got in this relationship. She tells me that her growth as a human has gone on a different level. She never thought she could be a leader. She could be a creative person. And because she was given so much freedom to speak her voice, and it made her confident enough to, you know, lead people to, you know, now she works with my father and she leads a whole team there. And she never ever thought she could do that. Like she would have like big arguments with my father that I cannot lead anyone. Put me in a department. I'll do what you tell me to do. And I clearly saw that she's, you know, she's not willing to do that, or maybe she's afraid of doing that. But it had to start with this relationship. So when I started, just who am I to, you know, possess her in my likings or dislikings? So I started giving her that freedom. And because she has always accepted me completely, like you said, she knew everything about you. She married you, right? So I got such an unconditional acceptance from her. So I was like, who am I to, you know, put her in my, you know, norms?
Well, your next book should be about relationships, because that is the best gift you can do. And it's harder said than, I mean, it's harder to do than said, because you just want to be lifting each other up always and letting that person be the best version of themselves.
Right.
But it's hard, so you should write that. I'm sure a lot of us can benefit from it.
It's on the cards, for sure.
Yeah. Oh, good.
Yeah.
What would you say if somebody What do you think, what fact about you would surprise people the most?
I think the fact that I can be just this normal, I don't know. I don't, like, honestly, I don't think I'm super normal also. But they have this stereotyped spiritual image of me, which I think surprises lots of people. Like, people do think I do not watch TV, do not listen to music. I probably meditate all the day. And I probably, you know, like, as I said, woke up in hospital on day one chanting mantras. So they have this, you know, illusion or this mental image of me constantly chanting mantras and being super serious. I've always loved watching
funny, yeah, what do you watch?
Funny movies. You know, I mean, Seinfeld was my shrine when I came to US. People told me, you know, to speak good English, you should watch news. And I did that for one day. I was depressed.
I would want
to go back now. I don't want to be here. So I started watching Seinfeld because I've always loved watching funny movies. So Seinfeld became my, you know, daily.
We still watch it on reruns in our house.
Right. It's amazing. It's all the funny shows, The Office, Seinfeld, you know, anything. Breaking Bad, it's not funny, but I like the dark humor in it, you know. House of Cards. So these, I'm a big fan of.
So what do you think of that relationship in House of Cards?
I think it's honestly normal, but I'm saying it because I have such a attraction for darkness in life. So it's a very unconventional relationship between Frank and Claire.
Yeah.
But I think it's working for them. I haven't seen the latest season, but the first two seasons.
Yes, we'll talk about it as if it's the first two seasons.
Right.
But it's interesting you said that because I've always been obsessed with that relationship for the same reason. I always said, yes, it's not conventional, but in their world, they are exactly who they need for each other.
Exactly.
And that's actually a recipe for a very good relationship.
They're playing that role for each other.
Yeah. And it's just like you said, if you can, they're lifting each other up. And for them, what's important is that world. Mm-hmm, and that's what they're doing for each other. It doesn't mean that'll satisfy someone else. But it's such an interesting portrayal of a relationship.
It's very dynamic, very powerful, I think, chemistry. I remember when I started watching it, I would tell Rupali, my wife, I'm going to be in my study, because that's how Frank would always say, I'm going to be in my study. So, I mean, the way they have portrayed that. And I know there were things that started getting messier in this third season
or so. Yeah, it's interesting.
But they'll have, it's a storytelling. They'll have to do that to, you know, continue the story. But I feel the first two seasons, the foundation of who they are as a couple, that's so powerful. And you have to see one thing, nobody could harm them.
No, because they were a team.
They were a team.
And that's attractive. I mean, right. no matter what the rules are of the relationship,
exactly.
I think that depends on the two people.
Exactly.
But the fact that they were so on the same page, and like you said, no one could penetrate them because they were the strongest together, that is so attractive. That's what everyone
wants.
That's
powerful.
And it's like if you're going to be with someone, you only want to be stronger with. Otherwise, it just feels like it's such a waste of your
exactly.
time.
Exactly. And, you know, I have seen this in my own family. Like, my father, you know, he's a very socializing person. But he has always been that person. And we have people, like, when I wake up in New York, I open my door and there are random people sitting outside. I don't even know. And in India, it's like five times more the number of people, because that's just India. And I realized that, you know, these people could do anything. Like, they're coming in, walking out. But my father, you know, he has this dynamic among four of us, that we are strong as a team. And nobody could penetrate that, you know, for us. So I learned that. I mean, Frank Underwood took that on a different level. but I saw that in my own family, that if you are strong as a family, you know, you could survive anything.
I love that we're talking spirituality and House of Cards. Right. Whoever, who would have thought that?
Right.
But it is true. It's funny, the same comment about that relationship.
You know, I extract my spirituality from these characters. I do not listen to spiritual teachers. I do not buy spiritual books. My spirituality has come so much from Jerry Seinfeld, Walter White in Breaking Bad, Frank Underwood in, you know, House of Cards. I mean, these are the people who, the characters that inspire me, honestly.
Also, the more flawed you are, I think the more you learn about spirituality. The more you can look at someone who has flaws or a situation that's flawed and understand it without judgment is actually where you gain more spirituality.
Exactly.
So it makes sense. At least to me, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. So if you had three words that you would say describe you.
Oh, me? So three labels?
Three labels. So just to bring it full circle, label yourself. And then we'll take them off.
I love the label of poet. I want to write poetry books. So I think that's something.
And you do write poetry. I mean, if you guys are not following him, you should, because he does write beautiful poetry.
Thank you. So I like the label of poet for sure. A seeker, poet, seeker. And how about the third label be no label? Like, it's just empty.
Label. I like that.
Right? Just emptiness. I like that emptiness in me.
Do you feel that there's a part of you? Do you feel emptiness ever?
Like, in a good way? Or
however you want to answer it.
Yeah. Emptiness, yes. I do feel like I'm very good with living by myself. And emptiness has been such a strong part of my journey. And I've always seen emptiness. I mean, if you read any books on Zen or Tantra, they do talk about cultivating the emptiness because people are afraid of being empty. And I feel for me, that's my daily ritual, that I want to empty out all the ideas, all the labels, and start the day with,
over.
With no labels.
God, if we could all start over every day.
Right.
It would be fascinating.
Right.
And not bring our preconceived notions.
Exactly.
I'm going to try that.
Right. Please do that.
I am. I'm going to try that. I think that's great. This has been amazing. I could talk to you for hours at a time.
Thank you.
I am going to ask you just a few quick questions, just like one answer things for our audience.
Nice.
But some of them you don't have answers for, and I already know that because it's just not how you practice. But what is your daily practice?
Daily practice is, it's WPSM, wake up, pee, shower, meditate. Okay, so I start my day with that. And I end my day with meditation also.
I like that you hold to peeing till after the shower.
I know, I got to do that, right?
Or was it wake up, pee, shower? Sorry.
Pee and shower.
I mixed it up.
And I start with WPSM. Then I just write down the things I want to do all day. And I do not plan my next day or, you know, I do not have big plans, but I just start the day with that meditation. And then I plan out what I want to do that day. And that's pretty much what kickstarts my day.
So you meditate first and then you write your list.
Absolutely. That's the first thing. WPSM.
WPSM. I like it. Now I'm going to get it in the proper order.
Right.
Thank God, because I would have been having to hold it and it just wouldn't
have. You don't have to. Yeah.
So this is one. What spiritual book resonates with you? But, like, it might not be one.
Yeah, none. I don't think so. Yeah, I can't come up with anything.
Is there a documentary or a movie that has moved you or impacted you?
The latest one, Ogja, that Netflix movie. It's about animal. It's not a spiritual.
It's okay.
Yeah, but it's Ogja. It's beautiful movie. It's about the food industry, but it's a human story.
So much about food lately. I feel like it's definitely.
I was watching our comments on, remember Amy's post you posted about food.
You write? Were you after me?
No, of course not. I wrote that you got to be educated vegan. You cannot be just wake up and declare that I'm vegan. I have been vegan for 10 plus years, but I felt sick in the process because I wasn't educated vegan. Growing up in India, everybody can be vegan because everything is vegan and vegetarian there. But over here, you got to be so mindful. I wrote that you got to get your blood work done, speak to your doctor, then understand your body. Don't be vegan for the heck of it.
Exactly. And that's, I wrote it quickly just because we're talking about, what is it called? Get Health? What's the documentary?
What the Health.
What the Health.
Yeah.
Which I have not actually
I haven't seen that either. Yeah.
But I've just heard so many comments. Yeah. From different doctors and nutritionists, actually some backlash on it, just saying it's not sound. It doesn't mean being a vegan's bad, obviously, but it just wasn't. It was a little bit more propaganda.
Exactly. You know, it becomes like religion.
And I like that you, a vegan, are kind of talking about that, too.
Yeah, I've never told anyone to go vegan. You know, never to my students, never to my clients, not even in my book, because I feel it's a personal choice. And you got to make it a medical decision, you know, not so much emotional.
Like you said, I feel like some people need meat. Like, I'm not saying everybody, it's just you.
People need meat and milk, and some people don't. If I have a milk latte, which I probably get from Coffee Bean now, and my stomach will be upset after half an hour,
right.
I just don't do well with milk, but I'm so attracted toward these lattes stuff. So
try maybe like an almond.
Same thing. But I think it's the sugar, the caffeine and sugar that does the thing, but I'll try that.
I'm the same way. I don't do well with dairy.
Yeah.
though I love it.
Right.
Same thing. I love it. So a teacher, is there a teacher? I mean, you mentioned Osho a little bit, but that sounds like when you were younger, before you kind of started forming your own.
Right,
then you said Gandhi. So is there a teacher that you kind of look to?
My father.
He has been my
all-time teacher. He's been such an authentic teacher. I've been to other teachers. He has sent me to other teachers. And the more I go to other teachers, the more I appreciate him. It's like, you know, you have a partner and you're like fooling around. But the more you fool around, the more you realize how amazing your own partner is.
Yeah.
So, my father remains the most important spiritual teacher.
And it's so nice for you because you guys have such an interesting relationship because you're so close on for so many levels.
Mm-hmm.
And he's an Aries, so I love him. If there was something you could have known before you kind of started your path and your journey, what would it be? But I feel like you were kind of born so wise that this might be interesting for you. But
Can you say it again?
So if there was something that, let's say, you know now that you wish you knew back then when you were younger, what would it be? Because you started your journey so early.
Right. I think it would be self-acceptance, probably. Because my big struggle in growing up years was to just be me. I always felt a misfit that I do not, when my friends play video games, I was, you know, just meditating. And I thought something is wrong with me. I was not happy in that skin. I wouldn't express my poetry very often. My friends would reach out to me when they had to, you know, write love letters to their potential girlfriends. I would write it to them. It would work. So that's how I would know that my poetry could work. Otherwise, I wouldn't express it out openly. So there was a lot of expression in me that never saw the light of the day. So self-acceptance, if somebody could have, you know, told me back then that just be yourself. You know, when you meditate, do it with open heart. Write poetry. You know, do your dance, sing your songs. Nobody else has to understand it. But I tried hard to fit in. And every time I tried, I came out unhappy and frustrated. So just being yourself, I think that would have been amazing. But again, it didn't happen. That's why I'm here now. You know, that experience obviously had a huge motivation.
Well, that actually leads us perfectly into this last practice for us that you said you were going to do, because it does slowly teach you self-acceptance and who you are.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't thank you enough. I always love chatting with you, and this was amazing per usual.
And those who are listening, I want to, you know, mention one thing. I've never, ever done weekly meditations anywhere. You know, I started my journey in New York, but Den was one place. I didn't even see Den. I only met you. And there was such a trust that I was like, if I had to do it, it was again like that marriage thing.
Yeah.
If I had to break the norm, it would be, you know, with her. So it was like that. If I had to break that norm of, you know, sticking to a weekly thing, because it was such a big deal for me committing weekly class.
I know, but it's amazing.
But it has been such a blessed journey. And Den is a place I never take for granted. It's such a, it's a home for me.
And I never take you for granted. And I'm so appreciative of you. No, but you, I'm always appreciative of our friendship. And then the fact that you trusted me that way, and the fact that you are literally intrinsic to who and what the Den is and who we affect. And that's always so beautiful. So thank you for that. This is Chandresh's personal practice, where he will guide us through meditation that just helps you relax.
Okay, so let's take this moment to relax, to breathe in, breathe out. And as you begin this experience, it's possible that your thoughts, your awareness, it's all over. And that's completely fine. Let's just take this moment to ask ourselves, where am I in my awareness? And let's use this question to bring our thoughts, our energy, right here in this moment. And now, start to experience a conscious breathing. Be aware of every movement of your breathing. As you're experiencing your breath, take a moment to connect with your awareness. This awareness is who we really are. You may know this awareness as consciousness, mindfulness, self-awareness, or soul, spirit, energy. Don't worry about the labels. Just be aware of this awareness and continue to breathe in and breathe out. And as you feel comfortable, bring this awareness right around your navel center. The navel center is the center of anxiety, suppression, and also freedom, creativity, confidence. Bring your awareness around the navel center and stay there. As you breathe in and breathe out, just witness what's happening within you. There's no need to fix anything. Just continue to be a witness. As you're witnessing your body, your thoughts, your emotions, ask yourself, who am I? Who am I? Is a question to witness your labels. Just witness them. There's no need to reject or accept any label. Just witness every label that shows up. Who am I? Who am I? Continue to witness every label. And now, drop the question. Just continue to witness the silence, the emptiness within. And now, as you feel comfortable, take a moment to feel your heartbeat, to feel this present moment. Then you can open your eyes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.